Welcome to Coaching Uncaged, the podcast that pushes the boundaries of the coaching profession with cutting-edge practitioners, authors, and thought leaders. Coaching Uncaged brings you pioneering thinking to enrich the art and science of coaching in all its forms. And now, introducing your host, Robert Stevenson.
Welcome to Coaching Uncaged, the Animus podcast, and today I am joined by the one and only Simon Weston. I worked with Simon a couple of years ago, taking part in his advanced coaching course, the Analytic Network Coaching. And today we're going to be talking a little bit about that. We're going to be talking about what Simon's doing, how his podcast is going. But first of all, Simon, if you could just do a brief introduction of yourself.
Well, Robert, thanks very much for inviting me for this podcast. It's great to be talking to you again. It's been a while. To introduce myself, not sure where to begin. I've had a long and mixed career. So I left school when I was 16. I worked in a factory. Then I trained as a general nurse, working with the dying and the sick. Then I got very interested in psychology. So I started to work in psychiatric nursing. I developed that kind of interest and decided to train as a psychotherapist. I became a family therapist, and I worked in Liverpool for a decade with families in deprived families with emotional and challenges, working with their families. That was a big piece of work. Very, very interesting. And then I got very interested in kind of why organizations and why leadership was not working, like in the health sector, and I was very frustrated. I cared deeply about my patients, but was very frustrated by some of the kind of systems around me. So I started management theory, and I went to the Tavistock Clinic to study psychoanalysis and the unconscious, kind of how the unconscious impacts organizations, because I worked out that through my management studies, the rational answers seemed to be pretty good. Kind of we knew kind of what to do, we just couldn't do them. So there was something else getting in the way. So I got very interested in the unconscious and kind of how that kind of impacts on how we work. And from there, I went to Lancaster University. I did a PhD. I did a PhD on leadership, which became my book, Leadership, a Critical Text, which is now in its third edition. It's selling very well. It's been taught all over the world now in business schools. And my big thesis really in that book was to think about kind of how we get trapped in discourses, ways of understanding leadership. So we get trapped in a kind of a controller discourse that we try and control everything around us, or we get trapped in the therapist discourse. It's all about people, about individuals and motivation and small teams, or we get trapped in the very common messiah discourse. We want a charismatic leader to come and save us, and they try and change organizations through culture control, creating cultures to kind of engineering cultures to impact on the workforce. And my final discourse, which I write about and I work all over the world teaching now, is the eco-leadership discourse. And this kind of emerged at the turn of the century and really is about kind of understanding not just the natural ecosystems, it's not just about the environment, it is about that, but it's also about kind of the technological ecosystems and the kind of natural and the people ecosystems coming together. So I talk about hybrid ecosystems. We have to be agile in a disruptive world, and that means understanding technology, it means understanding in the environment, it means understanding kind of the changing nature of society and people, globalization, and eco-leadership is a way of understanding that, and I developed that into kind of a theory and practice. And Just to say that what happened was I'd go around the world lecturing and giving keynotes, talks on eco-leadership, and people would say, "We get it, Simon, that's exactly right, that's exactly what we need to do. But how do we do it?" And that led me to develop Analytic Network Coaching, which is kind of a way of implementing these ideas. So it's a framework.
Fabulous, fantastic. That's such a rich and wonderful experience and journey that you've gone on. I'm always really fascinated about journeys and the journeys that we go on and the stories that those create. And as you were talking there, I was wondering how working with death and the dying, how that has had an impact on the work that you do.
Well, I think it's profoundly important. I mean, you're 18 years old and you're playing rugby with your mates and you're out drinking and partying. And, you know, I was a bit of a lad, enjoying myself. And suddenly you're confronted with, dying. You're in a A&E ward and you're in the emergency room. And five people come in from a big pile-up on the motorway. We were by a motorway junction, the hospital. And three would live and two would die, you know, in front of you. You'd have a young man on a motorcycle just passing away in front of you. And back in the day, there wasn't a lot of counselling. It was like Nurse Western, go and get a coffee, you know. So you'd kind of internalise the fragility of life. I think it had a massive impact on me in the sense of, I think most of us disassociate from death. We kind of push it over there somewhere. It's kind of like, it's what our grandmother does when she's old or happens in, you know, in that place over there. But, you know, like the way we sanitize it in the West, we kind of, even when people do die, we don't see it. You know, the funeral director takes a body away and we don't see it. But with this, it kind of, I got very interested in death and I got very passionate about caring for the dying. I actually enjoyed it. It's a strange kind of thing to say that you enjoyed. But for me, it was the biggest gift you could give to someone was to give them a good death, you know, and make sure that their family were okay. And I used to get kind of told off on the wards for, Nurse Weston, go and do some work. Stop talking to the patients. And I was like, talking to the patients is the work.
It's really interesting how that's so turned around over time. And, you know, right now we're in a pandemic and we're seeing lots of images of nurses spending time talking to patients as they pass away and so naming that that's part of the work that they are doing.
Yeah, no, it's really transformed since, I trained in the kind of 80s and stuff and it's really changed since then. There has been a huge shift. But still, there's been a huge shift and there's a big problem there. I mean, we get these narratives in the hospitals about the caring nurses, but the systems, the defences nurses and doctors still have, there's still quite a gap between, I mean, you get brilliant nurses, you get brilliant doctors who do this fantastically well, and you get kind of a system which doesn't really go to the places we need to go to. It's still quite, I think a hospital is still quite a dehumanising place. In spite of, you know, the best efforts of many nurses and doctors, the structures are kind of, for me, the hospital is still kind of like built on the idea of a factory. It's like, you know, you get sick, you go in, you know, they use the tools and techniques to kind of do something to you, and hopefully you come out kind of alive and better, and maybe not, but it's kind of got that model in its head. You know, we send people to these big buildings called hospitals, and it's kind of, I write about the hospital factory complex. And how we have to change that. We have to change that. It's kind of the wrong model.
Yeah, I know that when I was working with Creative Partnerships sort of maybe 10 years ago now, they also spoke about that, but from an educational perspective, this idea that schools were factories. You sent somebody in and then they came out the other side and they were a tool. You know, we made them into a tool to go and do a job, but those jobs no longer exist. And there was lots of a conversation around how are we creating creative and agile young people that can shift and move with the changing times, because the jobs we're training them for won't be there when they leave that space.
That's right. I mean, the models of our hospitals, our education systems are built on 20th century models of factories. It's like the Industrial Revolution was a model for this. And perhaps it served its time, you know. I mean, there were huge improvements in health and education, you know, so it wasn't like it's all wrong. But now we live in a different world and we live in a network world. We live in ecosystems, as I referred to, and we have to kind of deliver health in different ways. So health has to shift from kind of, it's also the idea of the doctor kind of being the omnipotent, grandiose person who kind of lays their hands on you and makes you better or not, you know. We have to take healthcare back into the community. We have to take education back into the community. We have to educate people for the world around us, not for some kind of, I mean, they go through the school factory, and then, I mean, the universities are getting worse. The universities used to be places of thinking, now they're places of production. It's like, now they're Walmart. It's like stack them high, pile them in, kind of put them through this kind of process, stamp their degree, and out they go the other end, and you know, what did they actually learn on the way?
That was really interesting. I remember working in universities when there was that shift from sort of external government funding to funding by the students themselves, and noticing how we went from this space of exploration and thinking to a space of let's get as many as we can in because, you know, we need to meet our budgets and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and the student is no longer a student; they're a customer.
Yeah,
and that changes things radically because the customer demands things, and they demand that the tutor treats them nicely and doesn't ask too many difficult questions, and they demand the right. You know, I've paid 7,000 for my kind of degree, or 20,000, or 30,000, or whatever you pay, and I expect a result.
Yeah.
So it's a different relationship.
Yeah, and it's. You know, as we talk about networks and relationships, it reminds me of being in the training room with you, you know, those years ago, and really sort of coming to grips with the idea of networks and the networks that I'm within and the relationships that then exist within those networks.
Yeah, so I think that's a big challenge because what I noticed in progressive thinkers is a lot of people doing systemic thinking, complex thinking, adaptive thinking. You know, there's lots of different names. There's chaos theory, you know. But there's a big gap between kind of the talking about kind of the big theories and people on the ground. And the analytic network coaching framework takes people on this journey from the depth analysis, which is really kind of working on your deep psyche, your soul, your purpose, kind of what makes sense to you in the world, meaning, deepening your unconscious insights. We then go on to relationships, which is kind of, this is like my work from a psychotherapist to family therapy, you know. So in family therapy, you realize that, you know, the child diagnosed with autism or school refusal as a problem is part of a system. You're not going to, you know, you don't just try to change the problem by kind of treating that kind of a child in isolation. You don't, you know, give them tablets, give them cognitive behavioral treatment is one, it might help. But unless you change the system, family system, then nothing's going to change. And that was a big lesson. And we do bring that into the coaching. So coaching is not just about the individual. It's about the kind of the individual, the relationships within their teams, the people, and then we move on, as you know, into the leadership. And then into the networks. How do we influence networks? How do networks influence us? That's a kind of key question.
And that notion there around, you know, it's not just the individual, it's their network and their relationships. I remember when I was doing a lot of youth coaching and I'd go into schools and I'd work with an individual and I'd say to the school, but now we need to work with the classroom. Because that individual lives within that classroom, and we also need to work with their families because we do great work here, and then they go home. So how do we bring everybody in? And as you were saying there before about, you know, how do we work with the community? How do we get everybody in to do that work to create that change as opposed to the one person kind of trying to do it all on their own and kind of push against the system?
Yeah, that's right, Robert. And I've been blogging and writing and about COVID and my latest kind of thinking is around social cohesion or social coercion. You know, there's all this stuff around Dominic Cummings and, you know, and then all the, you know, did he follow the rules, didn't he follow the rules? And there's people kind of from, I'm interested in people kind of from the progressive side of politics, you know, saying he must follow the rules. It's kind of black and white. We must kind of do it this way and that way. And for me, it's like, you know, Cummings aside, it's not about following rules. It's about kind of building social cohesion. This is only going to work if you get kind of mutual aid, if you get people helping each other, helping communities, doing things together, using their initiative. And we have to build that narrative rather than, like, you know, because black and white rules are not going to do it in this kind of scenario. There's too many kind of nuances. There's too many fluctuations. So we have to build a different mindset, really.
That really interests me, that idea about, you know, things aren't black and white, because I noticed that often in the coaching space, the client will want it to be black and white. Yeah. They'll want to, you know, have an answer, the magic pill, if we sort of bring the hospitals back into it, around the challenge that they're facing. and working with them to go, well, it isn't as simple as that. There are nuances and there is a gray space. And also when training coaches as well, helping them to sit in that unknowable space and be okay within that.
Yeah, I mean, that is the work. I'm developing leadership training really around that idea at the moment for like the post-COVID world or the continuity of the COVID world, because it's not going to go away quickly. But it's really about this idea that, you know, we have to kind of break the, again, that the 20th century kind of model was a modernist model, an industrial model, and it's a linear model. It's a reductionist model. It's built on reductionist science. And I'm not negating that, because again, this science has produced great healthcare, great medicines, you know, it produced some amazing things, you know, but there's an and to that and something else. Now, we can't reduce the whole world to that. Humans don't fit into that linear model very easily, you know. Networks don't fit into that linear model very easily. So there's a big and to it, and that's where I'm working on it, is this and, you know, so, and that's that place of not knowing you're talking about, Robert, and stepping into place where you have to decide without kind of just relying on the science or the data, because the science and the data will tell you lots of different things. And you still have to use your judgment and your thinking. And in the end, you have to be courageous and step into that space and make a decision on the basis of kind of what we know. But it's not all about knowledge. It's also about kind of other things.
And that sort of sparks a thought for me. In your book, the coaching and mentoring, a critical text.
Yes.
I really enjoyed the kind of historical journey you took us on, looking at sort of different frames. You talked about the friendship discourse and the healer, as well as the team. And there was something lovely going, this is what it looks like through time. Mm-hmm. And so where is it going now? And let's not get fixed with it. Because I think sometimes what happens is, you know, as we talk about schools and hospitals, they get fixed in time and go, this is it, we've worked it out, this is what it is, let's stick with that and let's not change anything. Whereas actually there is a need to be malleable and flexible and to progress with change as it arises.
There is, and we, you know, my work on discourses, I draw on Michel Foucault and different kind of authors, you know, to inform my work, but it's really the work with the unconscious is not just like some deep unconscious in me. It's like there's a social unconscious out there, and social unconscious kind of limits our possibilities. So we get set in certain frameworks of thinking, you know, coaching is this, or leadership is this, or you know, and of course that's very culturally determined. It's very socially determined, and it's very historically determined, like you just pointed to. You know, so if you say the world looks like this, well, it probably doesn't look like that in China, or it probably doesn't look like that in Ghana. You know, it's depending on where you are and kind of at what point in history and what kind of geographical, what context you work in. So it's taking, you know, everything I do is to try and say, you know, we have to kind of use critical thinking to ask questions and to kind of disrupt these kind of the logic which we think is normative, like this is just the way it is. No, it's not just like that. There's other possibilities.
I love that word disrupt. You know, we often talk about Animus, we talk about, you know, challenging and being courageous. And I enjoy that word disrupt because it has real energy and action to it. It's like we're going in to shake things up and to see what sort of falls out or what new perspectives we can arrive to through that disruption.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the words commonly used in sort of technology, you know, we're talking about technological disruption a lot. But people, I mean, one of the shockers I find in my coaching, you know, I coach leaders all over the world in a variety of organizations, you know, high tech organizations, kind of healthcare systems, retail, you know, the whole banks. And I'm amazed by, you know, in all of some of the kind of intelligent people I work with, you know, they're clearly highly intelligent, highly gifted, highly able. And yet there's a real lack of critical thinking. There's a real lack of people being able to actually kind of apply real critical thinking to question the discourses they get trapped in. Mm. And that's interesting. We live in a very conformist world. People talk about choice and freedom, but we live in actually a very conformist world, I think.
When you talk about critical thinking, how would you describe critical thinking?
The frameworks I use, when you talk about critical thinking, it doesn't go down very well in the coaching world, which is always talking about positivity and stuff, you know. But I'm not talking about being critical. I'm talking about critiquing, being able to critique, being able to kind of ask questions. And I have a framework in my books, and I probably can't recall all the frames now, but one of the key frames is looking awry, looking differently. And I use the image of a cameraman in making a film shot or a movie. If you think of the old Hancock films, they show the woman in a shower and she's looking relaxed and beautiful. And then the angle changes. They look awry. They look from a different angle with the camera, and it reveals something completely different to us. And that's what we need to do. We need to kind of look differently to see things differently. And that's why a lot of my work with leaders is to try and help them to look differently so they can actually see differently.
That's so kind of funny there. Talking about that movie, that Psycho. And I remember studying Hitchcock when I was at college and never really recognized that how he made his movies has therefore then had an impact on how I see the world and how I then coach and how I become a disruptor within my coaching. Because I'm aware that I often say to coaches and training and coaches that are colleagues, coaching isn't just about positivity and having a good time in that conversation. It is about challenging and facing the truth as it exists in that moment. And sometimes that's an uncomfortable thing, but we have to wrestle with that uncomfortability in order to make our shifts or our changes to come out the other side and then do what we want to do or achieve what we want to achieve.
We do, Robert. I'm worried about the coaching profession. I mean, I I'm a great believer in coaching. I think it's going to be a really important part of any change process because there's a lot of coaches out there doing a lot of work. But sadly, the coaching profession is a very conservative profession. The people self-identify as entrepreneurs, as change agents, as the thinkers. But a lot of coaches haven't done the work. They haven't done the work on themselves, and they haven't done the work intellectually to read, to understand, to be able to think critically. So they fall into very common discourses, you know, the positive psychology discourse. It's about making people happy. They think in very kind of linear discourses, the modernist discourse. So they're reduced to kind of, tell me your problem. What goal should we set? How do we get there? You know, with the five steps to kind of solving your, you know, all these different narratives, you know. How can we kind of make you happy? And that doesn't allow for lots of other questions. It doesn't allow for people to go into deep unconscious places and really understand what's going on in themselves and in others. And it's, this is the work I'm trying to do is in analytic network coaching, we talk about creating a coaching movement to challenge these kind of discourses, these modernist discourses, which are very linear. And they're not going to bring us into kind of a new paradigm we need to go to. They're repeating the old paradigm. And that's kind of a worry for me.
I was talking with Yannick Jacobs the other day. He's a positive psychology practitioner, an existentialist coach as well. And we were sort of wrestling with this idea around positivity. And one of the things that he said to me, which was really interesting, was, and he was talking about, you know, maybe this being part of his German roots, but just not wanting to just look at the happy clappy part of it, but also to get under the skin of the person. That's a frame that you can use, and there are great tools within positive psychology that you can bring into the coaching framework, but not to get trapped, as you were saying there, in that discourse that the client then has to be happy. And it's just seeking. I mean, yes, the client might be seeking to be happy as an outcome from the work, but the journey of the work, there will be unhappy moments.
Sure. And, you know, I'm sure there's people working with positive psychology in very, very good ways and doing what you're saying and working at a much deeper level. But the discourse itself, the things we see in all the texts or the writings or the websites or the narratives, it pushes us into, I wrote a blog a while back called the happiness imperative, It's like where you actually internalize a sense that unless I'm really happy, unless I'm really successful, I'm a failure. And there's a lot of young people suffering because they grow up with that narrative. It's put upon them, you know, that it's not okay to be kind of just yourself, whatever that means, you know, whatever that means, rather than kind of be successful as judged by the peer group or the school or the university, you know. And it's a very oppressive force, and it creates a lot of unhappiness. And you can judge that by the biggest place in the world where positive psychology and the happiness imperative takes place is the USA. Check out the USA's use of medications for depression, for suicide. On every metric, it's a very unhappy place.
It's really interesting how we take these ideas, and it's almost like we go, they're the answer to a problem, and we become fixed in that, and then we kind of blanket that over a society and push them in that direction to think that way. I know a lot of young people, well, maybe not young people, people now with social media at play, you know, getting caught in this notion that because I see my friends all, you know, out having a great time or eating great food, that's the consistency of their life. There isn't ups and downs. There isn't the dark or the shadow sides that also exist, but we don't show those on social media. We don't present those darker sides.
That's right. Now, it reinforces that kind of that whole idea about you have to be positive, you have to look good, you have to kind of... And in the end, you lose yourself because you get confused between the image of yourself, the performative self, and your authentic self, and that gap becomes wide, and that leads to depressions and conflicts, anxieties, and so many problems.
I could talk to you forever. There are so many thoughts popping up here. You know, how do we bridge that gap? How do we work with communities? How do we work with coaches to create critical thinking? I think, you know, I was talking to somebody else recently about, you know, how do we get coaches reading about their art form and their practice to really understand it and understand the sort of the frameworks? Where does that stuff come from? To be able to discuss it and wrestle with it and, you know, challenge their own thinking. So it'd be great to have you back to perhaps explore some of that as well.
Well, it's been really great talking to you, Robert. Yeah, so I'd love to come back. That'd be very good. I mean, just to let your listeners know, the other pieces of work we are doing, we have a coach training online coming up for... If you go to www.analyticnetwork.com, you'll find us, and we're doing online training now, which takes us into all the areas I'm talking about. You know, this is a deep piece of work, and we people get my book. So, you know, I encourage people to kind of actually really engage, and it's a kind of a transformation for themselves as well as for the work. And the other thing is my podcast, listening to that. Edgy ideas. The whole idea is to try and promote people to think differently, to kind of to look a bit more at themselves with this idea of looking awry. And we talk about coaching people to create the good society. What does that mean? And it's a question we play with throughout the whole podcast, really. How you kind of live a good life and create a good society. That's our big question.
Thank you so much. I look forward to listening to that and having further conversations with you. It's been a real pleasure having this conversation with you today, Simon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Robert. It's been great talking to you. Go well.
Goodbye. Take care.
If you'd like to watch these episodes as well as listen, you can find the video interviews on our YouTube channel and website now. Thanks for tuning in to Coaching Uncaged. Join us again for more captivating conversations, exploring the art of coaching.